BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to the Friday the 30th of January edition of Dialect. In the current economic climate, where we see bankers tearing their hair out every week, we have another in-depth look at the financial crisis. Or is it time to call it a catastrophe? Which of our banks is going to survive and which go under? Are we through the worst of it or not? Martin Summers joins us. The BBC and the Gaza Appeal, we hear from the demonstration earlier this week outside the BBC in White Ladies Road. We have Malcolm Greaves' weekly episode of The History of the Mafia and Jeff Spark's usual What's on Guide. All that and more coming up.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, I'd like to welcome once again, as so many of our eagle-eared listeners will have spotted, Martin Summers, who's rapidly becoming our financial crisis correspondent. He's a former researcher for the New Economics Foundation and currently a researcher at the Bristol Debt Advice Centre. Hello.
Hello there.
I imagine your debt advice centre is doing roaring trade at the moment, no?
It's certainly picking up, yeah.
Okay. The IMF has said something interesting today. What have they said and what do you think?
Well, they've said that that we're going into the worst recession since World War II. I suspect it's possibly the worst recession since before World War II, but the IMF themselves are now saying this. They're also predicting that the British economy will contract by 2.8% this year. And if you think in normal times, one would expect the economy to be growing by around 3%. That's a big change in perception of where the economy is going, and they're predicting that the British economy is going to take probably the biggest hit in the developed world.
How is it going to impact? If a lot of what financial crises come down to is confidence, surely saying something like this is going to decrease people's confidence even more and it's going to make the problem worse.
I think we're beyond that kind of talk. The financial system is completely broken. And arguing about it's like having a broken car and saying if we're all just confident enough we'll fix it and then we can get in and drive off. We need to actually face up to the fact that it's broke and call the garage or whatever steps need to be taken. We've gone beyond. I mean, when you're having little dips, confidence can be restored by you know, if we all just will it, the Morris Minor will reach the top of the hill. But not in this situation. It's just denial, really.
Right. How is having an economic crisis this bad going to impact us, seeing as many people will not have experienced something like this within living memory?
Well, I mean, the obvious way in which it's going to affect people is that they're going to lose their jobs. I mean, there's lots of steelwork jobs going in South Wales, electronics jobs are going. I mean, when we've had these talks before, that hadn't started yet properly. The crisis was still located in the financial system, in the banks. Now it's starting to really impact on the real economy. And, of course, this has a feedback loop on the banks. Yeah, so, you're now reaching the very dangerous phase of the crisis.
So where is our money safe?
Nowhere is a simple answer. Most people on the planet, and many people in Britain, have no money. This is what people forget when they talk about this stuff. Most people's, the way in which this is going to affect them is they're going to lose their jobs, or the prices that they have to pay for things are going to rise in real terms so that they can't afford basic necessities. It's those kind of things that are going to impact on people, most people, more than losing their money, which is really only a problem for wealthy people, after all. They're the only ones who've got any.
I mean, every hole has got to have a bottom. Where is this going to stop? What happens?
Well, it's not clear that there is a bottom. The only way a bottom was created under the system in the 1940s by World War II, so that the state really stepped in and swept away most of what the private sector had been doing and said, look, we're at war now, we're going to actually organise production, we're going to have a plan of how many tanks we want and how many people we're going to employ to produce those tanks, money no object. And that's how you put a bottom under it. But of course, it's a rather scary bottom. Otherwise, there's absolutely no reason. Right? I mean, the delusion that the economy naturally bounces back is simply, you know, it's just people saying that it's going to do that. But I don't think they've got any real reason to believe that it will spontaneously bounce back. Why would it? Once you start falling off a building, you carry on falling until you hit the bottom, don't you?
Yep.
And the bottom is not. You know, you don't stop magically before you hit the ground and then start rising again, do you? That's not the way it works.
So is there no real way, as you see it, for anybody to create an artificial bottom? I mean, we've been avoiding it through credit.
Well, I mean, you've got what I think is going desperately wrong is that the state is intervening to prop up the banks. And they've got to accept that the banking system is bust, it's broken, and not only should we not... the car is broken... And we don't need to fix the car, we need a new car, a different car.
Yeah.
Now, this is very hard for the people in charge to accept, because until 18 months ago, these guys were the masters of the universe. They paid for the politicians, they paid for a lot of what the politicians did. It was all very incestuous, and it's very, very hard for these people to accept that their game is over, like finished. It's not going to go on like that anymore. And they won't accept it, which is why they're making big mistakes in using up resources to try and prop up what's not... It's not possible to prop up.
Do you think, I mean, over the past 30 years, we've seen more and more of what we used to accept was state-owned becoming privatised. Do you think that's now going to go in reverse?
Well, it's already in reverse. I mean, in 1983, the Labour Party lost the election because their extreme manifesto demanded nationalisation of the banking system. Now, if we'd done that in 1983, we wouldn't be where we are now.
Hmm.
Now the banking system is being nationalised, but by the back door. So they're actually chucking money at it, but they won't actually admit that that's what they're doing, taking over the banking system.
What opportunity do you think anybody had to be able to foresee this problem?
It's been coming for a long time, but vested interests prevented the necessary steps to counteract the tendencies which have led to the crash.
Roughly how long is a long time?
Well, if you think it's the 1973 oil crisis was a big change turning point, and 1981 when Reagan and Thatcher were elected was another big turning point.
Mm.
And the deregulation of financial markets in the mid-80s, which Thatcher and Reagan pushed, that's the root of this crisis. There was a reason why those markets were regulated. It's to prevent exactly getting into this kind of mess. And people thought they'd learned the lesson of the 30s, which you don't have a free-for-all stock market. It's a dangerous thing. And we've forgotten that lesson. And, of course, vested interests made an awful lot of money out of the bubble. So it wasn't in their interest to say, hey, this is all going to end in tears, was it?
OK, so over the past 30 years, we've been slowly unleashing a beast which is now coming to bite the hand that...
Yeah, it's like Frankenstein's monster, yeah.
Right, OK. Who's in charge, really, then? Because the governments, some people would really say, are usually in charge, and other people, more cynically, would say, well, really, the banks are in charge. If nobody really seems to know what's going on, who now?
Well, I think the crisis has reached a point where nobody's really in charge, but the banks are still being feather-bedded. Yeah. So each new, what you could easily allow to happen is let the banks go.
Mm.
And then the government wouldn't have to spend 700 billion or whatever it is buying up their toxic assets. Once something's bust, it's bust. And you can buy it for nothing. So the government could then take over the infrastructure of banking, yeah, all of the high street branches, the automatic telling machines, all the rest of it, but not for money, for nothing, yeah, because the banks are bust. And then, of course, the danger with that is that what freaks people out is then the government would have to decide how money was created and invested.
Yeah.
And the question then is, of course, that this in the capitalist way of looking at things, this is terrible. The government's going to decide this. It's bound to turn into the Soviet Union. They'll set up camps and what have you. But in a democratic society, that's not necessarily the case. In World War II, we had a pretty state-run economy in Britain.
Mm.
But we didn't have mass extermination camps and all the rest of it because there was some kind of democratic control of that government. You know, it wasn't Nazi Germany, it wasn't Soviet Russia.
So it may well be that we need to set up new ways of thinking about institutions that is neither really government in the old sense or banking as it has currently been up until now.
Well, I think there's some, you know, people have got to remember some good old-fashioned stuff. The government is there to deal with the big problems.
Mm.
And you can't get around it, you know. I mean, what we really need is people in the government who know what they're doing and know where they want to go.
Well, do we have anyone like that? Because the people we have as chancellors or shadow chancellors are Vince Cable, Alistair Darling and George Osborne. Do any of these people know what they're doing?
In England, that's true. Of course, in Scotland, they've got other people.
True.
Well, no, I don't think any of them do. I mean, Vince Cable's been better than the other two, but even he has not really grasped the full extent of the crisis, and that it probably requires more dramatic intervention than has been suggested. I mean, I've got an article here by Simon Jenkins from today's Guardian, and he makes the point that, I'll just quote from this, he said, Darling and Brown, with full Tory support, Vince Cable is giving half-hearted support, are systematically depressing the economy. Yeah, so they're taking money off taxpayers who might spend it and give it to banks who are hoarding it,
yeah,
which is silly. The banks are not... If you're a private bank, you're not going to take money off the government and then lend it out. You're therefore making a profit. You're not a charity.
Mm.
Yeah, so the government giving them money is not actually leading to any lending into the economy. And he's saying this, and this is a very good point by Jenkins, I think. He says, this is not a matter of left or right, socialism or markets, free trade or protectionism. It's common sense versus stupidity. And at the moment, stupidity is winning.
The banks have shareholders. And if the governments are beginning to nationalise them, how come the public effectively own controlling shares in banks without actually controlling them?
Well, what they've got to do is, I mean, one of the things about a capitalist economy, if you're a shareholder and you make money on your shares year in, year out on a dividend or on the shares rising, is you are running the risk. Capitalism's all about risk. You're running the risk that you're going to lose it all. Yeah. So the wealthy people who own the banks have got to take the hit. Yeah.
Yeah.
They made the mistakes. They made the wrong decisions. They must pay the price. Who else? And of course, they don't want to, which is why they're wriggling around and using their influence with the state to protect them from the consequences of their own folly. Yeah? And this just can't go on. I mean, it's astonishing that a Labour government today is saying we can't do anything to help the steel industry, but meanwhile, well, here's another billion zillion quid for the banks. I mean, this is supposed to be a Labour government,
yeah,
you know, for the working man and all that stuff.
I mean, do you think there's, in the last great crash in the 20s and throughout the 30s, that worked in socialism's favour? Socialism doesn't really seem to be that great a force anymore at the moment. What do you see could be happening politically?
Personally, I would argue that we need to have a renewed green socialism, if you like. But what we haven't got is a political leadership which is actually articulating that vision. Yeah. People like Brown, who's supposedly the leader of the Labour Party, are not actually able to articulate it. They're too involved in the existing mess. But just like in the 30s, people are going to have to, you know, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. You know, people have got to go out and learn all these things all over again and make sure it sticks.
I mean, it looks like Labour, in order to gain economic credibility, really abandoned their socialist principles in so doing. Do you think a new chance will become for socialism to prove itself to be economic?
Well, we're not going to go back to the past. Yeah?
No.
What we need to look to the future, which is, you know, free markets, strong state, and a big third sector, cooperatives, credit unions, and so on.
Mm.
That would be, you know, what we need now is a vision of where we want to go,
right?
And then work backwards from there,
yeah,
to how to get there, and have a plan. Yeah,
okay.
The idea that the market will do it is just a fantasy. Yeah, the market on its own can't do it.
Bearing in mind, of course, that you work for the Bristol Debt Advice Centre, what is your advice to people? We've talked a lot about the theory and what's going on at the big scale. People in money problems now, what is your advice?
My advice to them is if you've got money problems, don't let it hang fire. Go to get help as soon as you can, because the sooner you get help, the better off you're going to be. And in actual fact, what I know from the people I work with is that it's not nearly as bad as you think it is. That what we would do at Bristol Debt Advice Centre, for example, is we would negotiate with your creditors, and each one of them would be, you know, we'd negotiate with them about how much they could realistically expect to get from you.
Yeah.
And some of them, that's going to be realistically nothing. Yeah.
Mm.
But we act as intermediaries between the people with debt and the people that they owe money to.
Okay. Where is the Bristol Debt Advice Centre, and how can you help people? How can they get in touch?
Well, I haven't got all the details with me. We're on the internet. We're in West Street in near Old Market.
Okay.
But there are drop-in sessions, but only on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. If you'd warned me, I could have brought some more stuff about that. But okay, I mean, we're on the internet, as I say.
Okay, well, if you can Google that, then certainly do. If not, we'll make an effort to broadcast what the number is, either later on or certainly in the next show. Thank you very much to Martin Summers.
Thank you very much.
Now it's time to head over to 1974, Johnny Bristol and his hit "Hang On In There, Baby," which I would like to dedicate to obviously anybody who is hanging on in there financially, I suppose. Did you get what I did there?
Hang in there, baby.
We'll make love tonight.
Don't be afraid.
That'll make it all right. I know just how you feel. Gonna hold you tight.
But we've almost got it made. Now that we've caressed, a kiss so warm and tender, I can't wait till we reach that sweet moment of surrender. We'll hear the thunder roar, feel the lightning strike. At a point we both decided to meet, same time tonight. Hang on in there, baby. Hang on in there, darling. I'm gonna give you more than you've ever dreamed possible. Don't be afraid, baby. Oh, no. Our sweet virgin of the world. There's true love between us, girl. So let us touch that crowd that every girl dreams of. Oh, we're almost there, darling. We're truly making love. Hang on in there, baby. Please don't let me down. Please don't destroy this new joy we found. That you say, something's eating at you and it's about to get away. Oh, don't fight, babe. Open up the door, 'cause that's the key to the freedom that we've both been working for. Let it go, baby. Let it go, honey. Oh, right there, right there. Baby, don't you move it anywhere. Go, baby. Let it go.
That was Hang On In There, Baby by Johnny Bristol from 1974. On Monday the 26th, the Monday that's just gone, about 100 people gathered outside the BBC building on White Ladies Road in protest. And this is regarding the four-minute humanitarian emergency appeal that the BBC has thus so far very stubbornly refused to show, despite the overwhelming criticism from the media and the public. Tony Gosling was there with his technological recording device, and this is what happened.
Humanitarian appeal. It's for children who are in hospital without medical supplies. For children who are in hospital without water, without clean water, without electricity.
Without food, without medicine.
We want food. Gaza, and they want to help. And the BBC has refused to air that broadcast, to put that appeal on the air, and to encourage people to give.
Sophie Gerner, I've been very disappointed indeed by Radio 4 News. If you knew nothing about it, you would think there were two neighbouring countries at war, but there's an immensely heavily armed and supported by the States to the tune of millions and millions in a very short time against homemade rockets, a corralled people who own the land and have been gradually displaced in their own land by incoming population.
So most of us think of Radio 4 as quite unbiased and a good source of news. Do you think this battle over in Gaza has changed your views about that?
I've been more scandalised by this than other things I've reported about, and I have to wonder why this can possibly be.
Why do you think it's so important to actually come out on a Monday evening to stand in the cold and protest like this?
Because it's so completely unjust a situation. The children in Gaza are underweight, underdeveloped. They can't live ordinary lives.
The BBC will say that they're making sure that people aren't, that they're not seen to be biased. And that if they were to broadcast this particular appeal, that they could be accused of bias.
I think everybody is perfectly able to see that it's a humanitarian cause that they're giving to. There's no problem about that. We've seen horrible injuries. We know that there are not enough hospital beds, intensive care places, and ordinary medicines. So it's clearly a humanitarian crisis.
Do you think it's just about this issue, or is there a wider problem with the BBC and the licence fee and the idea that we're paying for the transmitters that won't broadcast this aid appeal?
I haven't noticed. I haven't been offended by reporting by anything before this to such an extent. I can hardly believe it. That the ordinary person in the street knows that it's a very, very uneven situation. Some Jewish people have drawn parallels between the Polish resistance in the ghetto. It's rather like that. It's terribly, terribly uneven.
So what do you think's behind this move by the BBC then?
I can't imagine. I simply can't imagine. I can't imagine. I think they may be afraid of the huge Zionist lobby, and that's why I want to join an alternative lobby. I'd like it to be greater than the Zionist lobby.
You can tell from the amount of people here what outrage is felt by what's going on. And we will tell the BBC their coverage was not impartial, their coverage was biased, and now we know them for what they are. They have really shown themselves up. We want the journalists, we want the technicians to come out and join us. We want the journalists and the technicians and their union representatives to have meetings and tell the management, tell the BBC what they think about them.
I'm Mohammed Loradi. I'm here to protest against the BBC for refusing to broadcast the appeal for the Gaza people, the people who are suffering for the last 48 years, not for the last 6 months, for the last 48 years, because they've been the cleanliness of a human being from their homeland, which is the Zionist Israel, came to being by the UN support and Britain and the United States. And I'm against all this. And I'm here to support them. And the BBC should lift their embargo against Gaza. Thank you.
Well, yes, but the BBC would say that they would be accused of bias if they were to show this. So only the one side.
We they are on one side only, yeah. But we pay the license. We should have some say in it. They should give us our license money back.
So do you think that this is something that Muslims in Bristol particularly feel strongly about?
It's not just the Muslims. The half of Britain, I think they all feel strongly about. Because it's a murderous state killing innocent people. They haven't touched nobody called Hamas. They've only been destroying houses, hospitals, mosques, everything they can get hold of. Because they're cowards. They only hide behind walls. They should come in and fight if they want to fight, not stand from side and send in their F-16 supplied by United States and Britain also supplying them with drones and stuff like that. They should come and fight if they are many enough, but they're not. They're just cowards. They just want to take the people's lands.
So why do you think the BBC have done this then?
The BBC, because it's ruled by Zionist management. That's why they're doing it, and they've been doing it all the time. Because they support Israel wrongly or whatever. They support them dead on life.
This is just one example, though, of what you call a bias by not showing this. Surely that doesn't prove that the BBC is managed by Zionists.
I think it does, yes. Because they don't show, they go with whatever Israel does, they show them. But they don't show nothing about Palestine. Show nothing about the people suffering over in Palestine.
And of course, it's very difficult for BBC journalists, for example, to cover the Gaza bombings because they're not allowed into Gaza.
Oh, they can, because sometimes they get Reuters news wherever. They can get Al Jazeera news. They can get press TV news. They can show any if they want to. But if, when the Arabs fighting against Arabs, they show it all over the everywhere. But when somebody's happening to the Arabs, nobody will care. And especially the BBC, they don't care about the Palestinians. Only they care about the cause of Israel, which is from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, inshallah.
But you see, doesn't that chant actually mean that you want to see Israel wiped off the map?
No. I want one state ruled by everybody, long as justice for everybody. For everybody, justice. Not, they were only about 9,000 Jews in Palestine in 1946 when the Britain gave it to them. Now there's a few, they're bringing them from all over the place. They're all sorts of people. They give them money, the mercenaries, to go to Israel. They're not going by their own will. They only want to occupy land. That's all. But the people who live in there, they're cleansing them out, killing them out, try to scare them to leave. But those people, they're hardy, they will stay.
So if you think the BBC is biased, have you got any recommendations for our listeners as to where they can get their news from?
Yes, Press TV in English, Al Jazeera in English. They can get you through stories on live what's happening. No bias in it.
Making it clear. There are 80 MPs. By midday today, there were 80 MPs who put their name to a Commons motion condemning the BBC.
Yes! Shame on you, BBC!
Shame on you, BBC!
Give us our license money back!
Bristol MPs who have put their name to that motion are Roger Berry Roger Berry and Doug Naismith. We're waiting for Stephen Williams to put his name to it. Dawn Primorolo and Kerry McCarthy should put their names to it. There were 50 when they started, and there was 80 at midday. And the debate was being aired at 2:30 today in Parliament.
Hello, there is a charity organised by www.vivapalestina.org, which is they're organising a convoy trip from England to Spain, to France, through Spain, through Morocco and Algiers and Tunisia and Libya, then Egypt, then he goes to Rafah taking medicines, and anybody wants to help, they can log on to that website. Please support much as you can, donate medicine, ambulances, fire engines, anything. And they also need drivers. Have you got drivers which they can drive all the way to Palestine? This takes about a month. That going on the 14th of February. All the way to Palestine. It's going through France, Spain, Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, Libya, then Egypt, then Rafah, then all the way to Gaza, hopefully.
So if you want a Southern European and North African holiday, that's
It takes about 30 days trip, so please join the convoy and help much as you can.
Thank you to Tony Gosling for his efforts in recording that. That was the protest outside the BBC in White Ladies Road.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now it's T-Rex, and this is Children of the Revolution. Was Children of the Revolution by T-Rex. Now for another repeat visitor, I'm very glad to say we have Christine Ironside has come along again to read us a short story of her own creation, and this is called The Twins Economise.
Amanda rushed out of St Joe's in tears. She knew she was going to be late at catching the bus. Her mother used to pick her up in the car, and since she'd sold it for a smaller, more economical one, Amanda had to get the bus as well. She didn't mind this. She wanted to help where things were more economical. It was just getting used to it, when they'd always had Mum waiting with the car. And worse, they were going to a car boot sale. Auntie Sarah said they were a buyer's market, so they weren't selling anything there, just buying student paper, clothes, books, games and DVDs, whatever they needed to save money. Amanda's mother had just lost her job in the middle of Amanda's A-level course, and it was the credit crunch, so they were trying to beat the drain on the money that was happening to them and millions of others. Granny and Grandad, who lived in the country, emailed Mum. "They're using coal again to cut expenses," said Mum. Her brother Ivan said, "Mum will never do that. She's dead keen on clean electricity. The oil-filled electric radiators she bought recently saved more money. When it was really cold, she used them on top to top up the central heating. Ivan could not afford to go out with his mates so often, so he read more books as long as he remembered to return them to the library. He still had his job in the greengrocer after sixth form college at St Joe's, so he got extra vegetables cheaper." The twins, Ivan and Amanda, were coping. Other friends' parents were losing jobs, and some had strict economies wielded on them from their parents. Somehow it didn't matter so much, Mum being out of a job, because lots of others at St Joe's were in the same boat. Some parents owed thousands to the credit companies now, and it was hard meeting out the payments and working with what you had left. They were driving past bare trees stripped of leaves and buds at the tail end of winter. Trees stood out looking like tall tangles of knitting wool, unlike the warm cable jumpers Auntie Sarah had knitted for them. Food is essential, Ivan said on the way to the car boot sales. We're growing more vegetables in the garden this year. I've learned how to put tomato feed in the tomatoes on the veranda once a week to bump up their size. Nasturtium leaves are edible. They're like watercress. The food cupboards need to be always full so you're not stuck without food. You have to buy cheap where there is little money, said Auntie Sarah, steering out past a parked van. And some cheap goods are as good as expensive goods anyway. Sometimes a good product is cheap. It's clever to shop around. The pound shops are very good value and it pays to shop in them. I know, but the car boot is a bit low, said Ivan privately to Amanda. Auntie Sarah, who heard, retorted, not if you're buying. It's a boon. Even the charity shops are dropping their prices, but they're not as cheap as the car boots. Ivan sighed and kept talking just to Amanda. It's a shame you had to give up your dance lessons. I was never going to be a star. Might as well, replied Amanda. Her mother took that hard, not being able to pay for them, but she knew they were curbing the worst by making all these economies. Some expensive high street shops had bought in value lines, but you could buy new jeans and trousers for £1 or £2 at the car boot sales. Some stalls were like a market. We'll never be able to live it down, said Amanda, but she knew that they would, because they would have more money to spare by making economies and then realise it's worth some misplaced pride. Clever people make money where they can. It's a necessity anyway, she thought. Look, we've just got a smaller car and Mum still has the house, she surmised. We're the lucky ones so far. Others are St Joe's are being hit just as hard. Lots of parents are being hit by the credit crunch. Amanda's mother was cooking more home-baked food. I'll teach you how to cook, she said. I have more free time and we can save a lot of money and be healthier too. Amanda was thrilled. Mum didn't usually have time. Ivan learned as well. He was good at omelette with cheese or wild mushrooms. Their survival would depend on how much they saved money on little things, and eventually they would beat that need for credit and those expensive bills.
Thank you very much to Christine Ironside. Economise indeed. Perhaps we will go back to a yesteryear age like the Second World War where people root about in woods looking for hares to hunt. I thought the knowledge to how to jug hares had disappeared with my grandmother, but perhaps we will have to relearn these ancient arts. Now it's time to hear from Gloria Gaynor, She Who Warbled Rescue Me, which is always sung by a drunken lady standing on a pub table every week somewhere in Britain. But this is another one called Never Can Say Goodbye.
No.
Well, that was Gloria Gaynor, and when she said she never can say goodbye, she weren't kidding. That was a marathon epic worthy of Homer's Odyssey. Well, now time for Malcolm Greaves' weekly episode of The History of the Mafia.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. Although organised crime is as old as civilization itself, the image and mythology of Cosa Nostra, the American Mafia, is so powerful that it often almost seems as if the underworld was invented in the USA. Even in countries that have their own long-established organized crime groups and traditions, the specter of the Cosa Nostra casts a shadow of inspiration that impacts all over the world. From the dress sense of the Japanese Yakuza gangs, to the kingpins of crime in Mumbai, being referred to as dons. Despite its countless crimes and the mountains of misery it has caused, Cosa Nostra has become symbolic of a system of criminality that possesses a value system that prizes honour, respect and family ties. It is seen as presenting a form of ordered lawlessness. Criminals who can be trusted to obey a set of rules, which is typified by the infamous mobster Bugsy Siegel, who claimed, "We only kill each other." The question of why the Cosa Nostra became established as the dominant form of organised crime in the USA is usually answered with widespread Italian immigration, the pre-existence of organised crime in Italy, and prohibition. The American Mafia partly owes its existence to what preceded it. Organised criminality in 19th century America was dominated by Irish gangs. They represented an established network of criminal power that was entwined with political influence. In New York, street-level gangs such as the Roach Guards and Kerryonians had started out protecting Irish immigrants from anti-Irish violence. However, they soon gravitated towards control of prostitution, extortion, armed robbery, and control of the city's docks. The Democratic Party's political machine in the late 19th century, in parts of New York, developed links to the gangs, using them to ensure whole neighborhoods voted the way they wanted them to. This collusion led to a corrupt system. When the more than 2 million Italian immigrants left from the regions of Naples, Calabria, and Sicily between 1880 and 1910, they found themselves, along with the Jewish emigres from Eastern Europe, at the bottom of the food chain. They also found a corrupt political system that was in the hands of the same Irish crime gangs that were busy preying on them, even on the streets of what was later to become New York's Little Italy. In New Orleans, the city where the first Sicilian immigrants made their home, the mayor, Joseph A. Shakespeare, openly called Southern Italians and Sicilians the most idle, vicious, and worthless people amongst us. He also threatened to put an end to these infernal Dago disturbances, even if it proves necessary to wipe out every one of them from the face of the earth. Given these statements, is it any wonder that the Italian communities accepted protection from criminal elements amongst them? This protection, however, soon turned to exploitation. In Italy, a form of extortion known as la mano nera, the black hand, had existed since the 18th century. Victims would receive a letter telling them to give the sender money or risk death from the secret black hand society. The letters were always signed with a black handprint. Although there was no black hand society in America, the terror that these letters provoked created the perfect cover for Italian immigrant crime gangs to work under. Soon the black hand racket was rife in America. Even famous Italian celebrities in America, such as the opera singer Enrico Caruso, were at risk. Although unlike the majority of victims, he was able to call upon police protection. The most infamous black hander was Ignazio Saietta, Lupo the Wolf. He had fled a murder charge in Sicily in 1898 and came to America, where he worked for his brother-in-law, Nicholas Morello. Morello had built up the racket into a thriving New York mafia crime family that was eventually able to challenge the Irish and Jewish groups for a piece of territory. The growth of Morello's power perfectly illustrates the origins of the American Mafia and why it was so successful. Like other Italian gangs throughout America, it started out protecting its own community before exploiting them and turning the Italian immigrants' distrust of authority into an effective barrier of silence. Most books dealing with the American Mafia start on January the 16th, 1920, the day the 18th Amendment came into effect and Prohibition descended on the USA. There is no doubt that this day was probably the greatest day of all time for organized crime in America, but it more than just made the Mafia, it saved them from possible extinction. Before the First World War in 1914, the future of many organized crime gangs across America was already looking shaky. The reform movement sweeping the land that had begun to end the link between the political machines and the bully boy rackets of street gangs. Without political protection, many of the legendary gangs such as New York's Eastman Gang and the Wyos started to fall apart. Denied their previous lucrative political payoffs, gang rivalry for a share of other criminal rackets such as control of unions, gambling and prostitution increased at the same time as infighting fragmented their power. The traditional crime gangs were not only inherently dependent on their symbiotic relationship with the politicians, but derived much of their power from the size of their membership. In the early 1900s, the most powerful of the traditional gangs was New York's The Five Points, taking its name from the Carfax in Manhattan, where five streets converged. It was a predominantly Italian-American gang, with the likes of the young Al Capone and John Torrio. It reached the apex of its power in 1904, when its 1,000 members helped to elect George Brinton McClellan as mayor of New York. However, like all the traditional gangs of its time, the power was waning in the face of political reform. The Eastman Gang, run by Monk Eastman, could call upon 1,500 men for a massed fight. But controlling such a large number of members on a day-to-day basis required a solid organisational structure that was completely absent, and this made the gang vulnerable if anything happened to their leaders. The gangs also lacked a unifying philosophy, having been formed on a geographic and ethnic basis, purely to operate rackets in just one neighbourhood. Suddenly, a massive new multi-million-dollar nationwide illegal market had opened up, and the surviving crime gangs were in the perfect position to benefit by supplying the thousands of illicit speakeasies that sprang up overnight. It was prohibition, therefore, that would lead to the growth of the mobs and the rise of the mafia. If it had occurred just a few years later, the natural progression of Italian ethnic community and police harassment may have meant that the mafia would have been a spent force within the American organized crime scene. As it was, prohibition was to be their ticket to criminal glory and untold riches.
That was Malcolm Grieve, the actor, reading the weekly episode of The History of the Mafia.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
It's time for a man who, if he drove, would almost certainly have a bumper sticker that said "Disco sucks." It's our big friendly giant, Jeff Sparks.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 6th of February, and at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, Live Zeppelin will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Also on 6th of February, and at the Playhouse Theatre in Weston-super-Mare, Fairport Convention will be performing. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £17.50 each. Finally, on 6th of February, and this time at the Fleece in Bristol, the Larry Miller Band will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen. This group formed in Michigan in 1967 and are still performing to this day. This is from the album Alive in the Ozone, and it's a track titled Oh Mama Mama.
home tonight. When I get past your back door, swear I'll treat you right. You don't have to say you love me or say that you'll be mine. Fix me on my drink and love me one more time. Oh, my mama, just like 18 karat gold. Put the cream in my coffee, the honey on my roll. Play a thing, man. Tell me, mama, what's on your troubled mind? Tell me, mama, what's on your troubled mind? Pour yourself a drink of gin, I'll have another glass of wine. Well, now, tell me, mama, are you having any fun? Tell me, mama, are you having any fun? Oh, yeah. Who's that knocking on your back door? Better grab my things and run. It was only the milkman. Let's finish up what we've begun. Thanks very much. Thank you.
That was Commander Cody and his Lost Planet Airmen with Oh Mama Mama from the album Live in the Ozone. For more information about his musician, you can check out www.commandercody.com. Moving on to the 7th of February, and at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, The Beat will be performing as part of their 30th anniversary tour. Support comes from Guns of Navarone. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 7th of February, and at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, Storm Theory will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally on 7th of February, Fat Man Swings will be performing at the Hope Community Church in Hope Chapel Hill, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10.50 in advance and £12.50 on the door. And finally, on 8th of February, and at the Thecla in Bristol, The Popes will be performing with support from the Original Boys from County Hell. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that sounds like as good a recipe for any for ending a very cold and miserable January. Guess what? We've got a cold and miserable February to look forward to, but at least it'll be shorter. Well, on that bombshell, that's all for this week's show. Dialect is a community internet radio station, so we're broadcast on the web at dialectradio.co.uk and at bcfm.org.uk, as well as on BCFM airwaves at 93.2 across the city of Bristol. As ever, another shout out to the people of Preston who are also broadcasting us. How do you do? Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, assuming you're in Bristol, of course, either in reporting or on the engineering side, please do get in touch via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at www.bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you to our studio guests, Christine Ironside and Martin Summers. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling, and thanks to Jeff Sparks for his weekly What's On Guide As Ever and Song of the Week. Studio production this week was by Villis Trichkeren and Mark Condon, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Next week, we have more guests and fun, and I'm John Peters Coleman wishing you a very good week. From all the team in our Queen's Chair studio in Bristol City Centre, thank you for joining us, and take care.